With over 500 refuges across America, you don't have to go far to make a special connection with nature. Learn more at fws.gov/refuges. That's fws.gov/refuges.
Okay, forest animals, kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow, have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. River, how's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man.
I love it. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. Okay, squirrel.
The forest has been preparing just for you. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Cold steel, rough concrete, tough plastic, synthetics. Today's world is enough to make us lose our real sense of touch and feel hundreds of miles away from nature. Luckily, that's not the case. There are places all around where you can get in touch with nature, at the National Wildlife Refuges. Here you can experience the warm, inviting touch of nature at every turn. Feel the smooth, gentle bark of a white birch tree on your fingertips. Walk barefoot on the smooth, water-worn river stones. Feel the soft moss lining a towering wall of limestone. When you feel these things, you're feeling the world the way we found it. With over 500 refuges across America, you don't have to go far to make a special connection with nature. Learn more at fws.gov/refuges. That's fws.gov/refuges.
Expressed on the following show do not necessarily represent those of WHFR or Henry Ford Community College. Good afternoon, this is WHFR Dearborn, and you're listening to the program called Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. Today, my special guest is Cindy Gray. She is an author, handwriting analyst, yoga instructor, dream expert, and speaker. She wears very many hats. So she's a very talented lady. Cindy, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. How are you?
So far, so good. We'll see. It's still early.
Yeah.
You never know. But Cindy is here. She has written a book in the past, and she's going to be, in essence, reissuing it. Do you want to give us the title of the book and explain how you're going to, in essence, reposition it in the marketplace?
Sure. Thank you. The title is The Spirit of Health. The subtitle is Mind to Toe Self-Care for Women. It's a wonderful book that I'm particularly biased since I wrote it.
Yeah, okay. As long as you admit it, that's good.
And it was about 10 years ahead of its time when I wrote it, approximately. And I wrote it about 10 years ago. So I figured now might be just the right time to bring it back and put it out there and just see where it will go.
Mm-hmm. Well, why was it ahead of its time?
Well, back when I wrote it, a lot of the information that I had accumulated to put into the book, I'd researched it for years, I'd collected info on it for many years. A lot of what I've written about is now being spoken of more commonly. Advertisements, other books, music, radio, the media in general, and primarily it's to do with the fact that we are a product of our thoughts. You might hear the term psychoneuroimmunology, or PNI is an acronym.
I've never heard those terms, but it sounds very interesting.
Well, there's a lot of PNI doctors and theorists and so forth. For instance, people like Andrew Weil and Christian Northrup, Dr. Northrup. A lot of doctors now are, even Dr. Oz, for instance, is really, they're really promoting the concept that how we react to stress in our lives can set the stage for health or illness, our reaction to how we feel, whether it's even real or imagined, because it's one or the other, sometimes both, sets the stage for how our health is. And so I've known this all my life, and I've written about it. I've researched about it. I've lived it in many ways. I've lived the spirit of health. And that's what it's about, is how to create optimum health in your life by, first of all, connecting with the way that you are feeling. That when you become aware of your reaction to things, you can step back from that reaction, whether it's a positive reaction, negative reaction, or whatever. You can step back from it and observe it. And that puts you a little bit more in the driver's seat. And because of that awareness, you're able to focus on how it makes you feel, your responses. It can also reduce, in a physiological sense, it can reduce stress hormones from surging in your body. You hear the fight or flight syndrome and so forth, or reaction. That's an example of reacting, knee-jerk reacting to things in life. And we're at a time on our planet when everything feels like it's kind of speeding up a bit. And in many ways, it is. It is spiritually speeding up. It's technically speeding up. People feel it. And our reaction to ourselves promotes our reaction to the world. And if we can become a little bit more at peace with ourselves, we can promote peace on the planet. Because everything is electric. Everything has a frequency. And our health has a frequency, too. If you ever see someone you haven't seen in a while, and maybe they're not feeling too well, and you think, something just doesn't look right about them. You may not be conscious of whether or not you're seeing their aura or not, if you will, but you're seeing something about their vibration or their frequency that appears to be unwell. And the converse, a person can appear to be glowing, you know, and you don't have to be a woman and be pregnant. A lot of people say when a woman's pregnant, she's glowing from within and so forth. And she is, because she's got more of a life force going on. She's got two of them in there or more. And so we do tend to reflect on the outside what's being felt on the inside. And because of our interconnection with each other and with the planet, how we feel promotes how the Earth is responding. So we have a lot of people on this planet. Now is a crucial time for people to really start realizing their role in the planet's health, because it starts with their role in their own health.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people create their own diseases, in essence, by virtue of their lifestyle and their mode of thinking?
Not necessarily created. What I think is that people come into this world with a package, so to speak. It's a genetic package. It stems from the combination of their family and their genes, if you will. I'm also a believer in karma. You come into this world with certain lessons that you're meant to learn or deal with. There's a huge bit of free will involved. And so it's a real chemical soup in a lot of ways of things that create illness or wellness. I think that attitude is tremendous. People talk about negativity all the time. And you look up the word positivity. There is no such word in the dictionary. We don't even have that word. We focus so much on negativity, and there's so many people making so much money on this planet by selling drugs that are created in a science lab. You know, there's a lot of people that could be a lot healthier, let's put it that way. Through attitude, through healthier living, through right livelihood. There's so many people that are misemployed. They're underemployed, they're overemployed or unemployed. And that creates a whole energy of negativity that's very, very sickening to people. A lot of times, myself included, I've been blessed with being able to type really, really fast. I was a court reporter for almost 15 years. And it's a curse and a blessing. I'm a writer, so the writer side of me craves to write what I feel and believe and love, and I'm a talented writer. It's taken me about 50 years to admit that to myself before I could even admit it to the world. But because of my skills that are clerical in nature, I've been pretty much tied to a conventional side of myself, and I have my creative side. And it's so important for people to come together with what their talents are and their passions, what they want to do, because research even shows that when you do what you love, it sets the stage for you to be healthier.
Oh, right. It just really improves your mental outlook. Mm-hmm. And it does give you hope and some optimism, obviously, and just more energy. You know,
right.
I mean, you're ready to get up, face the day, whereas if you're in a job you don't like, you don't want to get up, you don't want to do anything sometimes,
right.
because you hate your life, in essence.
Exactly.
But you would say that you love your life right now?
I do. I'm doing a little bit more typing than I am writing.
Well,
but that's going to change this year. This is the year of transformation, 2012, in a lot of ways. And I feel that it's the year for me to relaunch myself. And a huge part of myself is the book that I've written. My book is almost 500 pages long. It's been called an encyclopedia of health, wellness, and spirituality. I've decided after a long time of praying on it, meditating on it, thinking about it, to bring it back out and consider a way to put it into a smaller format. There's several sections in there that are standalone books on their own. And then there's the primary, the guts of it, if you will. So I'm going to be probably doing that this year is the way I think I should go, the way I feel directed to go. And so my book is a huge part of my life. And I don't want to go to my grave with my song unsung. You know, that
right.
has to be done. That's part of my fate.
Right. Well, it's like Wayne Dyer has written in his book, Don't Let the Music Die in You.
I mean, right.
You've got to get it out and express it. So you don't think the world's going to end in 2012? I mean, a lot of people have kind of predicted that. You don't agree
right.
with that?
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Many times people have said the world is going to come to an end. I think what's ending is a lot of old ways of thinking.
Right. Like you said earlier, it's just a year of change, not necessarily
right.
the end or a year of destruction.
Or maybe the year of beginning.
Right. Well, that's just it. Transformation,
mm-hmm.
you know, from
yeah.
one state to another. Hopefully it's a better state that we'll be entering into.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So now your book itself, was it just too much information all at once? Was that one of the things that might have stifled somebody from reading it, just through the fact there was so much all at one time? And now that you're going to, in essence, break it down a little bit and give them pieces of it, will that be something that people are able to understand a little bit better?
Well, probably yes and no to a lot of your question.
Okay. That's a good answer.
Yeah. Well, the thing is when I printed it, when I first published it, I didn't want to go the traditional route by trying to find a publisher to say yay or nay to my book. I didn't want someone to control it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that, it's been my own inner reflection that I have felt controlled most of my life, and I wanted to have this be my baby. I didn't want someone else to sculpt how this piece of my art was supposed to look or was going to look. So I chose to self-publish it. And this was, like I say, about 10 years ago. And I'm not horribly high-tech, and I certainly wasn't high-tech 10 years ago. So there were certain ways maybe I could have approached it that I either chose not to or didn't know I could have. So I self-published it. I went through a digital publishing house in over by Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I printed 700 copies. And I pre-sold a whole bunch of them before I even got the actual product, if you will. And when I did that, I paid for each one of those books. Now, it took me a long time to write it. I'd quit court reporting. I was teaching yoga full-time, taking care of my mom, too, because she'd had some strokes and since has deceased. And basically, I sold them all right away, and I had spent so much to get that far that I didn't have anything left to pursue continuing it. So I thought, well, I'm going to uproot and I'm going to move to Sedona, Arizona, which is the capital of creativity, I'd thought, and it is in many ways. And I got out there and you could spit in the wind and you'd find a writer and a yoga teacher. Everybody out there was doing things similar to what I was doing. And I ultimately got stuck in a career that, like, I'd left from Michigan. Even worse, I became a 911 operator in Sedona. And I'll tell you, there's no job that's more thankless than being an emergency medical dispatcher. And I did that for nearly a year, and about killed me, frankly. That was one of the worst jobs I was ever proud enough to do. So ultimately, I moved back to Michigan, where I knew my people were here, basically, after a couple years out west, and started working again conventionally and paying my bills and fantasizing about the day that this book would be born again. And here we sit.
Mm-hmm. And very briefly, I just want to remind everybody, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This program is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. Today, my special guest is Cindy Gray. She's an author, handwriting analyst, yoga instructor, dream expert, and speaker. And we're talking about her book primarily. But I want to go back. You said you were a 911 operator. That must have been very stressful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Talk about stress hormones.
Right. Well, that would be, to me, that would be a very unhappy job to deal with because it's always panic and it's always something to do with, you know, violence or sadness or something like that.
Yeah, it was. And it was fascinating. It was interesting. I'm certain that some of my experiences there are going to be reflected in another book. I know that because I took notes. I'm like a divine stenographer. I take notes on taking notes, basically. But it was. I think I got a lot of gray hair from doing that job, and it was very, very upsetting a lot of times. There's not many good days you have, and there's a lot of people that are drawn to a job like that are what I call adrenaline junkies, and I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I like calmness.
Right. Or at least not in that respect.
Yeah. And plus, too, it's a tourist environment, so you have a lot of people calling for 911 for help that don't know where they're at. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are on vacation, and they do things on vacation they would never do.
Right.
We were also a regional communication center, so we serviced at least 9 communities. And most of these fire departments, if you will, and also police departments, have different protocols for each department. And so we had to know all those departments' protocols. Way too much data for anyone to have in their head, honestly. And it was like being an airline or an air traffic controller for life, you know. And I used to sit there, and I was scared because I just watched that board light up and think, oh, my God. And I did more praying in that job, I think, than any other job I've ever done because they always say that the dispatcher is the first responder because we get the calls first, and then you have to know how to deal with it. And a lot of people that called didn't speak English, too, and so they had the AT&T landline, or not landline, what do you call it, language line, I think it was called, something like that. It might be different now, but you might have to tell someone how to do CPR through an interpreter while they're screaming, and it was horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
it was horrible.
Let's move on from that. I don't want to drudge up any bad memories.
Well,
I thought it was just interesting.
I should tell you, though, one funny thing. Well, there's a lot of funny things with it, too, because it's all about humans, and humans are funny. You know, it's just how we are. There was an airport near Sedona in Cottonwood, Arizona, a little small municipal airport, and basically there was, to keep dispatchers sane, you play games basically at work, and we used to laugh to see who would have the biggest fall of the day. Because if any time anyone calls and say, you know, Joe fell, you know, well, you say, how far did they fall? Because if it's beyond their own height limit, it's usually a code for a head injury, and you want to stabilize the cervical spine and C-spine board and all that. So anyway, we'd laugh, and who got the biggest fall for the day? And I had a guy call once, and he needed... I said, well, how far did you fall, sir? And he said, 10,000 feet. And I thought, oh, my God. He had parachuted, basically, and he hit too hard, and he'd broken his legs and all. But he did. He fell 10,000 feet. So I got the prize for the biggest fall.
Wow. Congratulations, I guess.
Yeah.
Belated congratulations.
Yeah. Hope he's okay today.
Yeah. So with your book now, did you feel that you were channeling some of this information, or was it something that you felt you were just consciously putting out there?
It was both.
Mm-hmm.
It was both. I many times would get inspiration, instruction in my dreams. I'm a very, very vivid dreamer. I have prophetic dreams. I've had things happen that I was told in a dream the night before, and boy, it happened the next day. I've hit 3-digit lottery numbers a couple times on my dreams. I have dreamt them.
Just not the big one, right?
Right. I keep napping, though, and it doesn't happen. But, I'm a vivid dreamer, and I believe that that's an area where you can get a little closer to the source, your divine inspiration and source. And so I had a lot of stuff came to me in dreams. And I reference them in my book, and I have a section on dreams in my chapter about sleep. And sometimes I would get writing. I'd be in a mood, as I call it, where it would really, really flow. And I would kick out a section and sit back and reread that and think, wow, I don't remember consciously intellectualizing those words. I remember feeling it. I think it came from my heart, really. And that's like the opposite of a writer's block. That was a writer's flow. And I think it came from upstairs. You know, I really believe that inspiration does come from a divine source. And you can call it God and Buddha and Allah and whatever names you want to give it. But even the word inspiration means in spirit. When you look that word up, that's the root of it, is being in spirit. And so, yes, it was very channeled in many ways.
Mm-hmm. When you actually sat down, were you using a computer to type it out or writing it out?
At one point, certainly, yes. What happened was I had been collecting information on this book since high school, since the 70s. I even had an outline of it with the table of contents, which is very similar to what it looks like today, from the 70s. Because I knew someday I was going to write a book about these various ways to take really good care of yourself. Mm-hmm. That was my goal, because I've always believed in the power of nature and living in concert as much as you can, considering wherever you're at, to live healthily. So I'd collected information about that. I have information in my house you wouldn't believe. And people call me, it's like, oh, it's faster than the internet. So anyway, I had these piles of bits of info. And I was taking care of my mom at the time, and I decided I needed to get away to start this officially, or it was never, ever going to be anything more than a file. And so I got some help for my mom while I was gone. I went to a little cottage in Oscoda, actually, and this was in April, so it was cold, and there was nobody there, a couple turkey hunters down the way. But I rented a little cottage, and I brought my computer, which was a big clunky one at the time, and a whole bunch of books and all my material and my dog Molly, and I spent 2 weeks by myself in that cottage, and that's when I first put it into computer format.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I asked that is my mother used to be an automatic writer. You know, I mean, she would channel words. I was just wondering if anything like that happened to you, where you would actually sit down and you could tell that at sometimes it wasn't really you. It was spirit coming through you, and you were just putting down the words that you were receiving. Did that happen to you?
I think so, but I don't know if it would be technically like your mom did that. I don't know. I think that I was feeling it coming from above, but mm-hmm. I was conscious of it, mm-hmm. you know, other than in my dream stuff. I'd get right up and write stuff in dreams. But even now, I'll have sentences come to me that just out of the blue. And I know that if I have like notepads everywhere, and I write it down immediately, because I know I can never capture the exactness and the essence of that unless I write it at that moment. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a form of channeling. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Be nice.
It sounds to a certain degree that was part of it. I mean, if you feel that you're receiving something that you know that perhaps you're not consciously thinking of, you know, you're being inspired, if nothing
right.
else, you know, by
yeah.
the spirit. Right. Now, your original book, how many pages is that?
469.
And with the new edition, it's going to be cut down to approximately how many?
200-ish.
Mm-hmm.
That segment of the book.
Right.
And then there's other sections of the book that are standalone on their own, mm-hmm. too. So those will be, you know, the other 400 and the other, 200 and something won't be, you know, deleted or just left behind. They'll be routed into their own standalone book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is a work in progress. It's just not, you're not stopping with this book. There's going to be others to follow.
Oh, you
from
bet.
From the same book. And in
yes.
addition to that, you'll be writing more books, I'm
oh,
assuming.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, mm-hmm. yes.
Now, is it going to be with the subject of health, or just you're open to whatever it might be? It might be on yoga, dreams, whatever, anything else that you're involved
in?
I'm
a multiple genre writer. And like you said when you introduced me, I do a lot of different things. I have a lot of different skills. I have always prided myself on being able to listen to technical information and condense it and distill it into something that regular people can understand. And that's what part of this book is certainly about. And then just on another note, I have two amazingly wonderful dogs that are completely different from each other. And I've been accumulating bits of information that will go into a book about those two dogs. And it's the yin and yang of Stella and Quinn. Stella's a Chihuahua and Jack Russell, so I call her a Jack Wawa. And Quinn is a lab and a boxer. Now, they're both rescue dogs. They both come with baggage. Quinn is extremely mellow, very calm. Stella's not. Stella's happening. Everything's on Stella's terms. And it's like they're so completely opposite, but they come together. And every time I look at them, I think of a yin-yang symbol.
Right.
And the way they act can represent metaphorically or symbolically the way people are. Mm-hmm. And I can just, I look at my husband sometimes if he's real excited about something. I'll say, you are so Stella right now. You know, you're having a Stella moment. And it's funny, too, because the word Stella comes from stellar, which means star. And she is. She's my little star. And she is a little character. And I've told her, this is why you got dumped. You got to quit acting like that. She's destructive. She's crazy. She's her own worst enemy. I love her dearly. You know, and Quinn will sit there and look guilty over something she did. So they're completely yin and yang.
Right. But they're, again, opposites attract, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You feel that's the same way with you and your husband?
Well, maybe. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, sometimes.
To a certain degree, anyway.
Yeah, we'll steer clear of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a favorite passage out of this book that really speaks to you, that you're really proud of? Or,
well,
I'm sure there's probably many, but is there one that really comes to mind that you would like to share with us, perhaps?
Well, there is. I'll preface that by saying that the guts of the book is about that basically how we feel affects how we respond to our life, regardless of what we're dealing with. Being aware of your own reaction and yourself is one of the greatest tools you can have for longevity and peace. I broke the book down into what I call 7 essential elements for optimum health. And those elements, and it's in order of life, is air. You got to have air, right? You got about 2-3 minutes without air and you say goodbye. So it's air, water, nourishment, sleep, movement, cleanliness, and peace. You have to have all these things in your life. And when you look at these things, these elements, with spirit in mind, you look at them with the form of sacredness. And when you look at something in life that's sacred, it takes on a whole new meaning. You become connected to it. And that's what I think is wrong in the world right now, is people are disconnected. They're not only disconnected from their government, their country, maybe their states and so forth, but back that up toward themselves. They're disconnected from their own roots, from their own feeling of being sacred. We don't know where we fit. There's so many of us, too, and everything's going so fast. There's so much electronics, too. So there's electromagnetic fields, I think, are really zapping people around. Who knows? But ultimately, I think that our connection with each other creates a feeling of sacredness every day. And if you have that feeling, it can help you deal with things. It doesn't make life perfect. It just makes your reaction to it more healthier and on your terms. So the 7 essential elements for optimum health, I talk about how to include them in your life, how to have them be as pure as possible, if you will, and how to understand their impact on your life. And that when you treat those things with respect, you start treating everything else with respect too. So I have a chapter called Spirit, Faith, and Prayer, which was one of the most difficult chapters in the book to write, but it was also one of my favorite chapters. And I'll share with you part of that, if you would.
Yes, that's fine.
People often say that they've gotten away from their religion, that they've fallen. They tell me that they don't go to church or temple or follow the doctrines that were once a part of their upbringing. They sometimes hang their heads, they look down guiltily, and admit this like a confession. My response is always, but what about your spirit? Have you gotten away from that too? Are you following the doctrines of your heart and soul? In other words, your spirit. A look of surprise is often followed by a welcome discussion about the concept of religion versus spirituality. Then again, religion versus spirituality implies that one is opposed to the other, when at the heart of it, you cannot have true religion without spirituality, but you can have spirituality without religion. You don't have to be religious to pray, but you do need a sense of spirit. You need not belong to some group or institution to send your beautiful energy up and out from yourself to mesh with the energy of the universal source. For those who have fallen away from religion, there's often a yearning to fall into the arms of spirit. The beauty of connecting your spirit with that of the universal source is that everyone can do it, regardless of what religion or faith you may or may not ascribe to. Atheists or those who may be uncertain about what or whom they believe in still have a spirit within them. And when their spirit connects with this source, they experience a warm and wonderful bond between themselves and something greater. When a person, one without a religion or a particular belief system, stands at the edge of an ocean and they see before them a spectacular sunrise, and that familiar thickness forms in their throat, and chills run down their arms, and their eyes become moist with awe, they're connecting spiritually with the earth. A friend of mine asked me, "Why is it that I'm moved to tears each time I see a sunrise or a sunset?" I tell her, "It's because you're witnessing the source." You could say that she's moved because she senses God or Goddess or Allah or Buddha. It doesn't matter what you call it. It's the same thing. It's the connection with the source. It's too large to grasp with our intellect, but innately perceived by our spirits. This is the religion of all humanity. If you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, you will see people, on vacation no less, get out of bed before daybreak. Slowly they emerge from the hotels, sleepy-eyed, coffee mugs in hand, and make their way to the rim. They stand there quietly, chatting in the dark, and then in unison, as if on cue, they all turn. People of all nationalities and faiths, and they face the east and just watch. A hush comes over them as together they're seduced by the sparkle of golden sunlight as it splits the horizon with the most magnificent display of color on earth. It's like a spotlight from heaven, dancing streams of light with godlike fingers lovingly caress the canyon walls. Lost in a sea of contemplation, the only words you will hear are, "Oh my God," and "Wow." When you come from a place of spirit, you have the honor of being witness to the phenomenal sense of belonging to the earth. And no matter where you stand in life, you can connect with the universal source.
So everybody has that spirit within them, and they can access that if they only give themselves a chance, correct?
I believe that's true.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to necessarily be part of an organized religion to do that. Because just because you go to church doesn't mean you're necessarily a good person. I mean, it just depends on the makeup of each individual. Don't you agree?
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, I just want to once again remind everybody that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This program is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. And this month, my special guest is Cindy Gray. She's an author, handwriting analyst, yoga instructor, dream expert, and speaker. I mean, I'm getting worn out just saying all the different things you do. It's really amazing, and you do all those things well. Today, we're talking about her book primarily. Now, you are going to get this, I guess, abbreviated portion of your book. When will that be printed, and when do you think that will be out there for people to perhaps purchase?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I'm going to have updates on my website about that, which is www.cindygray.biz. And I'm not sure how I'm going to make it happen, but I have faith and hope that it will happen. I've been talking to spirit, if you will, about figuring out how to make this happen. I think that I need the advice of a very experienced agent to tell me exactly how to go about this. There's so many things that have changed, technically speaking. There's ebooks, there's all these different ways to read things and so forth. I want it to be able to reach the biggest audience is what I want, because I really feel that so much of this speaks to everyone. I only printed 700 copies. These were gone in less than 2 months. I had no distributor, I had no marketer, I had me, and I had these books, and I had for instance, a couple different book signings 2 days in a row. And I had people come back the second day and buy multiple copies. They bought a copy that one day on a Saturday usually, and on Sunday they came back and bought more for gifts for people that they love. And I've had emails from people over the years, too, that had gotten my book. And it's also available used. It's on Amazon. I had a yoga student once say, hey, your book's online. I said, no, it's not. She said, oh, yeah, it's online. It's like $5 or something. I thought, what?
Yeah.
No. And then I stopped and thought, okay, how should I feel about this? How am I gonna react to my own stressor here? And then I thought, well, that means it's out there. Someone's reading it.
Right. And so, whoever gets it is supposed to read it and absorb the material.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah. So you should be happy that it is out there, and it's still the essence and the words, the spirit are all out there, you know, getting things understood and, I guess, enlightened. You know, I mean, you're enlightening people on what they should do, what would help them just in daily life, correct?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I've had some people over the years comment to me that when they read my book, they felt that I was speaking to them. Mm-hmm. I've had people say that my story felt like their story. And I said, because it is. We all share so much of that. It's part of our human rootedness. Most sufferings that people have, it's really the worst thing you can do is feel alone in things. And because we're not alone, we're not. And that's one of the worst things anyone can experience is feeling emotionally alone. And I think that my book touches on that, and it people can read that and think, oh, wow, I just thought that I felt that way. It's so reassuring to know that people share your sorrows and your joys.
Right. Well, it's got to be gratifying that you're actually able to help people understand what they're going through and improve their own lives.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's what we're all meant to do, and that's what I do as a yoga instructor too.
Right.
Is help people get in touch with their breath, get in touch with their spinal alignment, with how to make themselves feel good. And I touch on yoga in the movement chapter. That chapter specifically focuses on walking, dancing, deep stretching in general, and yoga specifically, because I think those are the four things that really help people. Be the best they can be, regardless of their health. Everyone can usually do one or some of those things. And usually when people say, oh, I want to lose weight or whatever, get in shape, you should really start with walking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many people say, I'm going to start running. It's like, and then they end up blowing their knees out a week later, you know.
Well, either that or they spend hundreds of dollars on the gym and they stop after 3 months because it becomes work. It's no fun. And again, if you'll notice, right after Christmas, all that exercise equipment goes on sale because everybody makes those New Year's resolutions.
Yes.
I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to lose weight. You know, that's what you're saying. So they go out. They buy the expensive equipment. 3 months later, it's a clothes hanger. I mean, that's it. I mean, you just throw clothes and junk on it.
Yeah.
And you don't use it anymore.
Right.
So that is how you provide service to others, by instructing them in yoga, through your writing, and this is really how people generate income, actually, I believe, is whatever service it is you provide to others, I think, is not only helping yourself, but helping others as well.
It should, you would think, yeah.
Yeah, you would think. It doesn't always work out like that sometimes.
No, but it should, yeah.
Right. Now, you said that you've been collecting information ever since you were, well,
a few
years younger.
Yes.
Okay, a kid. So this is something, though, that you've had on your mind. Were you inspired, you know, at a young age that, yes, this is what I'm supposed to do, either be a writer or to write this book, or
yes.
both?
Yes, yeah, both.
Mm-hmm.
And to teach. And that's really what my book is. It's a very strong teaching mechanism. As a child, I always wanted to be a teacher, and I am a teacher in my yoga and in my life. And we all are in our own way, because we set examples for the people around us and the younger people and so forth. A part of this book that I think is part of the roots of it for me was my grandmother on my mother's side. They were, my grandma Eunice was Southern and my grandpa Sam, and they were farmers. And I have a section under the nourishment chapter, because remember, it's air, water, nourishment, which is food, but it's also spiritual. And matter of fact, I'll point out in the nourishment chapter, I talk about the importance of gratitude for our food. and saying grace before you eat, regardless of who you necessarily aim that prayer to, just being conscious of the fact that you're blessed, that you've got food, and so many people on this planet don't even have clean drinking water, let alone quality food. So in the nourishment chapter, I speak about that, and I also talk about how a lot of kids in the world don't know where our food comes from. And my parents, or my mom's parents, were farmers. And they were farmers in Michigan, and I got the joy of being on their farm all summer long. And they weren't, you know, like dairy farmers or anything. They were produce growers. They farmed and they sold it. They had markets in Michigan, in Livonia and Plymouth area and stuff. And I just remember my grandpa scooping up the dirt, and he didn't call it dirt. It was soil, and he could tell whether it was good for planting or not by the smell of it, by the feel of it. And you know, he loved the earth, and I remember seeing that and feeling that, and I learned from him and from my grandma. And they would be out, you know, before dawn shucking with big John Deere tractors. They had a team of hands. They called them the hands that would work on the market. They were seasonal workers that would help them, and they would harvest the things that they grew. And there was so much pride that they had in everything that they grew. He grew the best sweet corn, oh, in Michigan. Oh, I loved his sweet corn. And I just felt a tremendous appreciation and link with our planet through my grandparents and through their farming and their pride. They were so proud, you mm-hmm. know, and they worked hard, and they didn't make a lot of money. They really didn't, but that wasn't their focus. Their focus was on what they were raised doing, and their relatives, my ancestors before them were farmers down in Tennessee. So I've got my Hungarian side on my dad's side and my Southern side on my mom's side. And so I mentioned in the nourishment chapter about my Hungarian grandmother and how her cooking was and how her house smelled. You'd walk in that house and, oh my God, you'd start to salivate just walking in there, you know, and the goulash and the cabbage rolls and the things that she would make were so delicious, and she took such pride in that. And they canned their own vegetables too, mm-hmm. quite often. It was just the way that they did it, and the pride in that, and the cultural heritage. I think a lot of times, a lot of cultures, their ancestors, they live in the home until they pass away. You know, the birthing bed becomes the sick bed, and later on, the death bed. And a lot of our people, if you will, at least in the United States, end up in nursing homes. And children don't see as much of their grandparents and great-grandparents, and they're not exposed to that elderhood that a lot of other cultures are. So, and I speak to a lot of these issues in my book.
Mm-hmm. So it's addressed to modern society, would you say?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it takes into the fact, again, family structure is much different than it was, I'm sure, in your grandparents' day.
Right.
It was more of an extended one. Now it's a little more chopped up. Most mm-hmm. wives are working, working families. So I'm sure that plays a role in people's health and people's just being able to take care of themselves and just handling daily life.
Yeah.
Do you feel that?
Oh, definitely. And you see things in the media, like the return to the slow food movement. You know, there's people that talk about that. A lot of products that are named now are called simple. You know, you
right,
rush there and
everything's green or
yeah,
right, something.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a start. Mm-hmm. And the thing is to realize that these resources that we're labeling and trying to slow down or speed up or control, they all have a sacredness to it because they come to us through earth, which is God-given. And when you think about it, if you think about the everyday, daily things in the terms of being sacred, then it becomes sacred to you. Every day becomes sacred. And you know, a lot of times people will say, gosh, until my so-and-so passed away or until I had this near-death experience or whatever, I didn't really appreciate life as much. It's a shame that we have to get this profound level of appreciation by loss or near loss. And so maybe a lot of this that I've written about is a wake-up call, mm-hmm. you know, that think about it now while it's not gone and nurture that and love that, enjoy
right.
that. You know, recently I've gotten together with some of my Hungarian relatives, and my parents were both only children, so all of their aunts and uncles were really my great aunts and uncles. So they were all a lot older than I was as a child. So recently we've kind of reunited and enjoyed some parties together that didn't involve, you know, a funeral and didn't involve a wedding. So that was great, and a lot of the foods and all. And it's so cool to sit back and listen to them tell stories and kind of go back to where I was in my head as a kid. And I remember thinking, my dad used to say, well, we're going to go over and see cousin so-and-so. It's important we go see them. And I used to think, why? I don't want to go over there and see that old guy, you know, or whatever. And I didn't appreciate it then. And now, and I'm in my early 50s now, I go and I visit with relatives and I think, wow, it is so neat to be able to see them and to choose to see them. And how thrilled my parents would be and grandparents to see that these sides of our families are still linked, because that is a link to our roots. And maybe it's because I'm older now, maybe you become more sentimental, but I think what it is you start appreciating that that is your link to your own mortality. That is your link to your life. And those people know your story. They know they've seen you, the warts, everything, you know. Excuse me. So I'm not sure where I got off on that tangent.
Well, no, it's just what you said. As you grow older, you have different perceptions. You know, it's not quite as bad. You have different thoughts as a kid, but maturing as an adult, you realize and you begin to appreciate some of the things that when you're a kid, you just take for granted.
Yeah. You don't maybe treasure the value of it. How could you, though? You know?
Right.
That's part of growing up.
Right. Well, that's just it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're so absorbed by your own little world at that time that you're thinking that, like you said, I don't want to go see so-and-so, you know,
yeah.
this adult.
It's
I can't
important.
Relate. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Right.
But then years later, you have a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just to remind everybody, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This program is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. My special guest this month is Cindy Gray. She's an author, handwriting analyst, yoga instructor, dream expert, and speaker. Now, how would you tell people or perhaps suggest to people on how to improve their lives and live a better life in that they can improve their health and improve their lives in general? What would you say to that?
Love. One word, love.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Go about things in the most loving way you can. And one example is when I drive down the road and you get a goofball in front of you or whatever, and they're doing stupid things.
Be careful. I could be a goofball. So.
I like to call those people my cousin.
Okay.
All right, cousin.
Right.
Slow down, whatever.
Just one big happy family, right?
Yeah, and it helps me adjust my perspective at that moment. So not only do I not send hateful thoughts to that person or say things I shouldn't or whatever, but I think about we are connected. And who knows? Maybe that person's on their way to the hospital. You don't know what people's stories
right.
are. To try to be less judgmental. And just observe things. Step back from yourself a little bit. Take a deep breath and observe how you respond and how you react to things. I think in terms of health, one of the most important things that people can do is to avoid chemicals in their life. There are just so many chemicals we're inundated with.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, oh, you can't avoid that. Well, you can't avoid all of it, no, but you can avoid some of it. And it's important to learn to read labels and understand what all these multisyllabic things are that somehow someone chose to put into these products. You see a lot of commercials and media things for instance, breast cancer and all these pink ribbons. We're being strangled by pink ribbons. And yet a lot of the companies that use these pink ribbons and they promote races and things like that and sports things to benefit research, and I'm not bashing research, don't get me wrong, but these are body care products that are filled with carcinogens in their products. And I think, how are they getting away with this? Even the fragrance industry alone, last count was over 800 carcinogenic, cancer-causing chemicals that go into the fragrance industry. These are sprays, body lotions, spritzers, shampoos, conditioners, you name it. And then they say 2% goes to research. I'm really troubled by that. The hypocrisy of it is so, I don't even understand how they get away with it. And a lot of the fragrance companies, you don't see ingredients on those lists, on the boxes and stuff, on fragrances, because it's proprietary recipe. They don't have to put it on there. And I don't know how they get approved. I don't know how genetically modified organisms got approved.
Right. Well, again,
it's
all about the money, it seems, is what it boils down to.
And it's the best way to protect yourself is to educate yourself and to try to eliminate that in your house, in your household.
Right. Well, I think, didn't they just discover there's a certain amount of lead in women's lipstick now that could affect
that comes
their
and
health?
Goes.
You know, but, again, something that might be, you know, not good for a person in general.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And then there's other companies that can make products that don't include those things. Those products need to be sought after and purchased and, you know, applauded for their purity, really. A lot of things aren't healthy in our world. Microwave cooking. I won't even get into that because that's a whole other thing.
Good, because I depend on that.
Well,
I know it's not good. Well, again, you know, it's what you mentioned earlier. It's just not what you put into your body, the chemicals and stuff, but it's the things outside of our body.
Yes.
All the different radiation and waves that are going on. People are concerned about using, you know, the cell phones and stuff with brain cancer, this, that, and the other, the Bluetooths.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, there's a lot to consider that we are being bombarded with on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this planet globally is kind of strangling ourselves with technology. Mm-hmm. It's the age of knowledge, age of technology, age of knowledge. It's a shame it's not the age of wisdom, you know, because when you go at something with the concept of wisdom, you think about it in terms of consequences. I forget exactly what Native American tribe there is, but there's a quote that they think of things in terms of seven generations forward. What's the impact on that? And that is sitting back and observing your own responsibility in your actions and how it can affect others. And, it's hard to get away from things like that, but one thing you can do, too, is to slow down. Have meals as a family, even if you may only be able to do it a few times a week, but to have meals as a family. It's so important for people to link. And even in the summer, plant your own garden. Even if it's some herbs on a deck, even if you have an apartment, you can plant some things and just watch them grow. Take the time to slow down and just observe things is one of the most health-producing things you can do. And walking. You know, my dogs walk me. They walk me. And I appreciate that because I think of Earth as my treadmill in a way, rather than working out in a building with, you know, fluorescent lights and what have you. I like to get outside and take my dogs for a walk. And you meet your neighbors that way, too. You see things and you experience the seasons and watch them. And you have a deeper link with again, the sacredness of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So people should just step back, take a deep breath, and appreciate life.
Yeah, that sounds pretty simple, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. Not easy to do.
Right.
Now, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, I have a website, which is www.cindygray.biz. My email address is info@cindygray.biz, and my business phone number is 734-266-2734. Like I said, my book is not available new at this time, but it is available on Amazon and in different places.
Right.
I don't mean to
the
promote.
The original version, though.
And it'll probably say on there dedicated to Martha or somebody, fine. But Susie can buy it or Bill or whatever. And I would re-sign it for them, too, if they wanted. But I did produce 700 copies, and they all hit the bricks, and I've got about four of them in my possession that I saved. And I hope to relaunch it. I'm not sure exactly in what format or how, but I have faith that that's going to manifest this year. And then it will be available in a newer format for people.
Mm-hmm. Now, why didn't you just publish more at the time when you sold them all out? That wasn't an option?
No, because I didn't have anyone sponsor this. I paid for it all myself,
right.
And it took a long time to actually write, and I wasn't making a lot of income at that time, so I kind of, every dime I had went into that first lot. I expected to have other lots happen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that you could reinvest the money you made from the sale of the book originally and get more published. That didn't work out.
I was paying off Peter to pay Paul and
doing a juggling act.
Mm-hmm.
Was that it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, I noticed that you have been using a crystal on and off throughout the interview. What does that crystal do for you? I'm just curious. I hope I'm not, you know,
no.
blowing your cover, so to speak, or anything like that. But
no, this is an amethyst crystal. I'm born February 1st, so my birthstone is an amethyst. I was born on my grandpa's birthday, February 1st, my farmer grandpa, which is pretty cool. And his name was Sam, and my daughter's named after him, Samantha. I have a definite strong link to this crystal. And people laugh about crystals and so forth, but they a lot of times they don't realize that they're in a lot of our technology. Crystals help with the frequency. I find, I don't know how to describe it. I like to hold it. Interestingly, too, when my father passed away 23 years ago in 1989, he died February 19th is the date he passed away. He had a stroke, and then he died a few hours later. And I was with him when he passed away, and I had this crystal with me, and I had it in his hand. And I clutched it in his hand with mine. And then a little while later, I don't know, a year or two or three, I don't know, I was doing handwriting analysis at a party, and there was a lady there that was doing tarot or something, and she would use, she was a psychometrist, and she would, for instance, you know, you'd see someone take grandpa's watch, and then they'd hold it and give you vibes about grandpa or whatever. So we were waiting for the guests to arrive, and I went over there, and we were trading readings. I did her handwriting, and she did a reading for me, and she said, "Let's see that crystal," and she held it, and her eyes got real wide, and she had chills. She said, "Someone died with this in their hand." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "And he wants you to know he loves you very much." And that was not prompted in any way, shape, or form, because as a person who does readings, I'm hip to how people can prompt you as a reader and how humans can prompt each other. Anyway, but I'll never forget that, because I know that the feelings of my dad are somehow embedded in this crystal. So I think that everything holds a psychic imprint. And crystals have are more of a sponge for that imprint.
Mm-hmm. So crystals mean a lot to you.
Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm.
Well, Cindy, thank you very much for being on the show today. Really enjoyed the interview, and good luck with the book. I hope it works out very well for you, and I hope this is a year of great change, and get out there and promote that book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your interview and your time very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, I just want to thank my special guest this month, Cindy Gray, for being on the show. Very interesting interview. I hope she's able to do what she wants to with this book. It could be a year of great change for her. I know that's something very important to her. She's always wanted to be a writer. Hopefully this will be her year. I also want to thank Lynn for helping produce this edition of Metaphysically Speaking. Be sure to come back next month. We'll be back on Tuesday, March 20th, so be sure to join us once again. And right now, I just want to remind everybody out there that coming up is another Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair. This will be our fourth event. That's right, count them, four. And it's going to be happening Saturday, March 24th, 2012, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., in the Student and Culinary Arts Building on the campus of Henry Ford Community College. If you're interested in joining us for this fantastic festival as a vendor, reader, or body worker, please call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, the telephone number, 313-317-6540, or the email address is holistic2010@peoplepc.com. You know, we'd love to have you be a participant, but if you're unable to do that, by all means, come out, enjoy the event. We'd love to see you there. It's going to be another great event. We're going to have local musicians playing music, and it's all going to be free. We've got some great speakers lined up this year, so be sure to check them out. All students with a valid ID, student ID, will be allowed into the event for free. So be sure to keep that in mind if you know any young people out there that might want to attend the festival. We'd love to see you and the young people out there as well. So once again, that's the Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair, Saturday, March 24th, 2012, right here on the campus of Henry Ford Community College. And once again, like I said, next month, be sure to join us for another edition of Metaphysically Speaking on Tuesday, March 20th. In the meantime, I want to thank everybody for listening and have a great day.
The English and World Language Division announces the 37th Annual Francis G. Barrett Creative Writing Contest and 17th Annual Larry Coulter Poetry Competition. The contest is open to any student currently enrolled at HFCC. $700 in prize money will be divided among the winners. For submission guidelines, check out michiganave.hfcc.edu. Or for more information, call 313-845-9716. All script entries are due by March 15, 2020. Romancing the Figures, an art exhibition opening January 25th through March 16th, located in the McKenzie Fine Arts and Fitness Center here on the campus of HFCC. Six prominent artists from the Detroit area will showcase their work, which has been featured in exhibits such as the Detroit Institute of Art, the National Gallery of Zimbabwe, the Allen Stone Gallery in New York, and the Little Rock Art Center in Arkansas. Romancing the Figure exhibition hours are Monday through Wednesday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., or by appointment. For further information, visit hfcc.edu or call 313-845-6485.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continued...
Romancing the Figure is an art exhibition opening January 25th through March 16th, located in the McKenzie Fine Arts and Fitness Center here on the campus of HFCC. Six prominent artists from the Detroit area will showcase their work, which has been featured in exhibits such as the Detroit Institute of Art, the National Gallery of Zimbabwe, the Allen Stone Gallery in New York, and the Little Rock Art Center in Arkansas. Romancing the Figure exhibition hours are Monday through Wednesday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., or by appointment. For further information, visit hfcc.edu or call 313-845-6485.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and